Hello, I'm Jen Watt. Welcome to the Schools of Wellbeing podcast. This podcast invites you to listen to conversations I am having with fellow researchers and academics who explain the schools of thought that influence what they think well-being and well-becoming means and how it connects to schools, students, teachers, educational leaders, and wider communities. I also have vibrant conversations with K-12 educators about the inspiring ways their schools are living out well-being and well-becoming. My motto for this podcast, come for the joy, stay for the flourishing. I'm so grateful you are joining us as we think about how to live well and thrive in schools. I have known Dr. Thomas Valkenburg for just over a decade now. He was one of the four professors from the Faculty of Education at the University of Manitoba who designed the transformative teaching, learning, and leading PhD cohort that I took part in as a graduate student. So I knew Thomas first as my teacher. I later started working for him as a research assistant, and now, since I was hired into a faculty position at the University of Manitoba, Thomas is my colleague, mentor, and a generous collaborator who has invited me and many other researchers and educators in Manitoba and beyond to think collectively across disciplines about what well-being and well-becoming means for our schools. Thomas is someone who has a gift for conceptualizing the big ideas of well-being and well-becoming, but he is equally committed to putting ideas into action. In this episode, we talk about how and why he created a framework for understanding well-being and well-becoming in schools, and the kind of educational partnerships and research initiatives he currently leads. I actually live just about 5-minute walk away from Thomas, so normally you and I would be sitting down to have a conversation face-to-face, but we are making sure that we are doing our social responsibility here in this time of COVID, and so we're meeting over Zoom. But I really thank you, Thomas, for being able to be here and share your stories about your research and your partnerships with people working in well-being and well-becoming in schools in Manitoba. So thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
I'm going to start by asking you a little bit about how you found your way to exploring ideas of well-being and well-becoming in schools.
Yeah, and in some sense, if I go back into my development as a person, as an educator, as a scholar, and use the framework that I'm now, the lens that I'm looking now through, then I'll actually find that that has always been a driving force in what drove me to become an educator in the first place, which started in grade 11 with an outstanding social science, what we would call here a social studies teacher. And what attracted me to that teacher, as well as the work as a social studies teacher, was really the engagement with the, as I would now frame it, with the question of flourishing lives of society more broadly and of individual human beings in particular. That drove my interest in the education system and becoming a teacher. And then later, after I've taught for a number of years in the Canadian school system on the West Coast, I decided to pursue postgraduate work, doctoral studies. And I had the immense fortune to run into then who became my longtime friend now and then teacher and supervisor, Hee Soon Bai. She was very influential in shifting my first, what I would call the first shift from a more general understanding of flourishing and first understanding of what education is about towards, I would say, two things. One is more towards an ethics of care, the ethical component of education. That was very influential. And the second one, I think, as important to my life, was the focus on the inner life, on the personal development, so that it's as an educator and as a scholar, I'm not just looking outward and deal with ideas outside myself, but I actually see my own development and what drives me as a person and an educator as an integral part to my scholarly work. And we'll probably get to this a little bit later when we talk more specifically about well-being and well-becoming. If I consider what drives me in my life and what I was just briefly hinting at, then it's not a surprise that well-being and well-becoming is really a central element in my work, because once you turn towards your own and the personal, to your own inner life, you noticed how we are driven by a need, great desire to actually find, let's say, meaning in life, which we'll talk about later, right? The social connections, enjoyment in life. And so I think this all came together more accidentally in my doctoral studies than even my doctoral work, which was using the ethics of care to frame teacher education and teacher education programming, was really driven again by the question, what do we educate for? What's the purpose of the education endeavor? Then responding at that time, it was a focus on moral education, ethical education, ethics of care. That was what drove me. But I think nowadays, looking at, from this, the current perspective, looking back, I'll say it was really at the center. It was really the question of living a flourishing life. What do we need it for living a flourishing life? And what can education at the different levels contribute to that?
That's excellent. And I think that really leads to a big question that I know I get asked a lot when I tell people that I'm researching well-being and well-becoming in schools. I'm guessing people ask you too, what do you mean when you talk about well-being and particularly well-becoming? Because that's a term that maybe some people might not be particularly familiar with. How are you currently conceptualizing those ideas?
I thought maybe it might be helpful to start off with the question why I was particularly drawn to develop this particular framework you were referencing, and that is basically at the core of my answering your question directly. And it was driven by really, I'd say, two concerns that I had once I got about 10 years ago or so, more closely connected with the literature and the idea around well-being and flourishing and living a flourishing life, eudaimonia, happiness, as it was back then called. Was clearly a shift from 10 years ago focusing on happiness to now talk more about well-being, less of well-becoming, as you pointed out. So that's an interesting question, what that might mean. And so when I engaged starting about 10 years ago with the literature and scholarship around happiness, flourishing and well-being, I was a little bit unhappy what I found in the newer scholarly literature on the conceptualization of human well-being. It started out with an, I think, unquestioned assumption that we consist of different departments as human beings, and then the well-being consists of the well-being of these different departments, which then led to notions like of phrases like mental well-being and physical well-being, social well-being, and sometimes even spiritual well-being. So the idea behind this is, and I think unquestioned generally, is that we have these different elements and we need to be well in all these different components. And I think what I found not that satisfying is that what was missing was that well-being was based and grounded in a meaningful, developed theory about the human being. What kind of biological beings are we, and how do we function in different aspects? Because once you get started thinking in those terms, then you quickly get to the conclusion, I at least did, that we can compartmentalize ourselves. We can't say we have there is our minds, then we have the body, then we have the social connections, and then there is somewhere spirit available as well to us, or to some of us at least. And that was very dissatisfying, because in some sense, when you get deeper into theorizing about human beings, you'll find that in some sense, everything is mental, because it is our mind that helps us to make sense of everything, that actually give us the experiences in the first place, that guide what we pay attention to in the world, how we see the world. They actually determine what we identify then as a stimulus in a given situation. So it's not that they come at us and we, like a printing press, take this on, but we actually shape what the world looks like to us. So if somebody has pain in the leg, for instance, right, it's our mind that gives meaning to that pain. So if you, for instance, have a mindset of, without pain, no gain, then that pain in the leg can be a positive indicator of your life. Whereas if you suffer from pain and the least pain is the best circumstance for you, then you will frame that quite differently. Then there's this literature of the embodied mind, so you can't really separate both. And so all that said, there is a certain level of dissatisfaction with this separation into different departments. And so then the question arose for me, how do I approach a well-being concept? And of course, if the critique is there wasn't really a solid or a good foundation in terms of understanding how we function as human beings, then in reverse, if I want to build an understanding of well-being and flourishing, I'll have to start with what does it mean to be a human being. The other concern why it was important to conceptualize well-being, the kind of motivator for me as an educator and educational scholar, was really the understanding how important a conceptualization was for making a difference in the education system and society more broadly. Because it is that understanding of what do we mean by well-being that provides us with direction for everything else, right? For assessing policy, for the practice in the classroom. It's guided by how we understand it. And so the more we can make this explicit, I guess the better it is. The other dissatisfaction that I had with the scholarly literature, and that had an influence on how I then shifted and started with developing a framework for human well-being and well-becoming, was that there was in the literature often a mix-up of what I would call the how questions with the what question. So we might find in literature on flourishing, especially the ones that want to be very concrete and supportive, which I do very much appreciate, you find recommendations like be active or be social, engage with others, right? Play a game. Now, these are not definitions of what it means to flourish or to live a flourishing life. These are more means towards that. So they are more responses to the question, how do I do that? How do I achieve it? How do I accomplish living a flourishing life? But it doesn't articulate what it is that we would accomplish with that. And so in some sense, I felt I needed to get back to the drawing boards there. And so going back to the drawing board, I was influenced by a number of ideas that I got from the literature. So one of the ideas came from Gordon Allport, which is an American psychologist, quite well known for his personality theories from the 20th century. And he faced a similar, dilemma or challenge, better to say, in his developing his personality theories, because there were so many out there. And he found positives in all of them to some degree. And so he actually made the case for what he called a systemic eclecticism. So in a systematic way, you pick and pull from the different insights that the different disciplines, the different approaches, the different paradigmatic approaches were providing, and then put things together with the assumption that, the different lenses to which people looked at, in his case, personality theory or the human being as a person, all had something worthwhile to contribute. And so why losing all of that? And so in this spirit, I've tried to draw together from different theories about well-being and flourishing lives, from psychology, sociology, and particularly also philosophy, as the main three Western academic disciplines that engaged quite intensely with the question of well-being. And I try to bring the what I considered worthwhile ideas together in some form. And then the second big idea was to actually use a framework to bring those together in a kind of, to use Allport's work, systematic way. And that came from a European researcher, Ruth Van Veenhoven, who had around 20 years ago looked at the different approaches to well-being and conceptualization of well-being and tried to systematize those by identifying two dimensions by which he clustered the different approaches to well-being. Maybe I'll say a few words about those, because I think what he accomplished with his 2x2 framework was really pointing out some underlying principles about human well-being that I think need to be considered and that help us, or help me at least, to draw in a systematic way what I found valuable in the different approaches to well-being in the different disciplines. So one dimension was the question of inner and outer aspect. So he identified that in the different disciplines, that looked at, and the different theories that looked at well-being, some of them focused more strongly on the inner aspect of well-being. So what is in you? So like enjoying life, that's something that's in you. You enjoy this as the individual. Whereas others emphasized more strongly outer aspect. So that might be how we live, the conditions we live in, the social, political context in which we live in, as crucial components of identifying whether you live a flourishing life or not. And so I thought both were important to consider. There is something in us that we need to give consideration when we say, I live a flourishing life, but there's also an outer component, because as human beings, we not just have an inner life, we also have an outer life, and both of them interact. We are social beings. We are embedded and shaped by the social conditions in which we are brought up and thrown into at birth, and from which we take on the values that shape how we see the world. And so we have an inner and outer component there. And so that's the first dimension that he identified. And the second dimension that he identified was the distinction between potential and actual experiences. And so he identified that in some theories about well-being, like in the capabilities approach by Martha Nussbaum and Amartya Sen, the focus is really on what they would call the freedom that we have. So our well-being is identified by the choices we can make, that we have the potential to make, and the freedoms we thus have to choose a life that we find worthwhile living. So that particular approach emphasized very much the potential that we have that's in us for living a flourishing life. And of course, that comes from a Western liberal, and Nussbaum isn't shy about saying that, political liberalism. That's one of the prominent philosophical approaches in the West that speaks to the value of freedom that we have, the individual choice. And the same dimension is, Van Hove identified the actual, what he called, life results. So not just the potential that Nussbaum and Amartya Sen emphasize, but also what actually happens in us or with us. And so if we enjoy our life, that is really kind of life result. We actually have these experiences. There is not just the potential of making our life enjoyable, but we actually enjoy life. And to me, that made that distinction between the potential, the freedom on the one hand side, and the actual experiences, the in time experiences, a part of our life, made also sense as components of our well-being. So in this sense, then we have this matrix of inner aspect, outer aspect on the one hand, and freedom and life chances and life results on the other. And so I use that as a guide to then develop a framework that used that.
So when you were developing that, and when you were thinking about that, I know that as an education researcher, you're thinking about it probably both in terms of like how educators might be experiencing their well-being, but also how children or youth in schools are experiencing it. How did that kind of play into what you were thinking? Was it sort of a way of thinking through that? And is there anything that you have to think about differently when you're thinking about it from the more of the student's perspective? Or does the framework work across the age span?
Yeah, that's a very important question. I mean, if we look at this genealogically in the development, in terms of the development of the framework, I was really at that time concerned more generally with human well-being and the conceptual of framing that concept. And of course, with the education system in mind, but that didn't factor into this development. So I was really looking and drawing also on literature that talked more generically about human beings, and often literature that made reference to adults. And the question then, well, with that kind of framework, does that need to be adjusted or maybe reshaped, or are there other components if we consider children or if we consider the school system? That's now questions that I'm more recently dealing with and working with. And actually there's a paper coming out that doctoral student of mine, Heather Krepsky, and I wrote, and that will come out at the end of this year, where we look at drawing again on different scholarship in different disciplines, where we may draw on that those disciplines and making the case that there is actually an important difference between childhood and adulthood, and that based on that difference, it requires to make some difference between child well-being and adult well-being. But that's still in the infancy. Yeah, at the moment, yeah. But there's a lot of literature out there at the moment discussing that.
So when you're talking about well-becoming, you're not necessarily just talking about, you know, that as children, you want to work towards well-being as an adult. Well-becoming can happen at any stage, or how would you maybe use your framework to discuss the difference between well-being and well-becoming?
It started all out 10 years ago with the term of well-being. And at that time, some of the literature, most of them I mentioned, is used more happiness, but some of them used well-being. Well-becoming was really not, the term wasn't really used that broadly, but I did come across the term in two ways, and both were influential in my understanding of the well-becoming and why I thought it is important to actually emphasize well-being and well-becoming. The first one came from the so-called social indicators movement, which for the last 70, 80 years was collecting data on the well-being of children. And so originally, actually, in hindsight, although the language was used that way, they were more concerned with well-becoming, where they made the distinction, because at that time, the focus of children was really, and the concerns, the social concern for children, at least as far as social services, health services, and then at the academic end, social indicators movement was concerned, children were seen as those who became adults in the future. And the concern for the children was to support their development towards well-being as adults. So in that sense, the concern for the children was really more framed like well-becoming. And that's the language that they use. And then they switched over the last 20, 30, 40 years in the social indicators movement towards a concern for well-being, namely the concern for how are students right now, children right now as children, not as future adults or as beings developing into adults. And so they actually switched from a well-becoming focus to a well-being focus to a good degree due to the influence of the child rights movement, which emphasized the importance of the distinction between childhood and adulthood, that childhood is not just the phase that you have to go through in order to be an adult, but it's actually a life phase on its own, with its own conditions, with its own qualities, and its own possibilities. And so that was one way in which I encountered well-becoming, namely in, you could say, in a temporal sense, that well-becoming meant you're focusing on how well will you be in the future. So that was the well-becoming, and the well-being was your well-being at this stage. I found this is clearly something important to consider, and in the education system, we hear that debate often, right? The education system is for you, this is for your future, your education is for your future. So the concerns and the distinction between well-being and well-becoming play out in the education system as well. Usually different terms are used, but that's the idea of the distinction between concern for your life right now and your concern for your life right now for the purpose of future development plays out in the education system as well. But I found this distinction, while important, less interesting, and in the end, I think also less important. The more important understanding of well-becoming, or it is less trivial and much more important also for the development of the framework and how it can be used. And that is the notion that came from my engagement with the particularly the psychological literature around personality theories. Because, and again, I'll refer back to Allport's work. There's a little booklet that he published, I don't know, if maybe 50 years ago or 60 years ago, that he called Becoming. And that was and at the core of this was really the notion that as human beings and as persons, we are constantly becoming. We are not beings, we are becoming, so to speak. Because everything that we engage in, even this conversation that we have right now, will leave us as different people once this conversation is over. In education, we call this learning, and there's often informal, non-formal learning, and that shapes us. So we are constantly on a process. So from that perspective, the question of how well are you is really secondary in light of what your current state means for the future and your development. But the second element of this well-becoming idea is that development and that learning is not accidental. We actually have a certain propensity towards development in certain directions and becoming a certain and develop certain qualities in us that we might have taken on. Some of us might be brought in with when we were born, but others come to the socialization and enculturation, that we have the tendency to develop in certain ways. So I think if we look at well-becoming from that perspective as a concern for human beings, I think it's a much greater concern than it is the question of the well-being. And in some sense, I would actually say well-being is a sub-concern for well-becoming. The well-becoming, which direction do we develop into, is a much greater concern because we develop constantly. So the question, the concern for in which direction do we actually develop is a much more important question for each of us individually and for society at large than the question, how are you at the moment? And maybe I can illustrate this with an example from the in the education system. They also, this understanding of well-becoming compared to well-being also pose quite different questions. So the well-becoming is concerned with the state of affairs and asks state of affairs questions like, do you enjoy school? And so we focus in on the state that a student is in. Do you enjoy school? Do you have these or those capabilities to help you flourish as a student? So we're looking at the state of being. When we're concerned for the well-becoming, we are actually, in addition, wonder about processes and the readiness for the development. So we might, rather than asking, do you enjoy being in school? If we are focusing on well-becoming, we might ask questions like, do you know when you are enjoying something in school? Or do you have strategies you can use when encountering a time you don't enjoy school? Right? So it is much more geared towards the state of being as is of importance to developing further as a human being. So, and in this sense, I think this is a lens to which everything, enjoyment, living a meaningful life, having agentic capabilities, etc., from the framework needs to be looked at. And that's why I would actually love to give up the term well-being, and just focus on well-becoming. But I think one has to be also somewhat strategic about the language that we're using, which was in the end why people moved from happiness to well-being. I think it is still appropriate to use well-being as well. So that's why it's a little bit more complicated to say this, a framework for well-being and well-becoming.
Yes, but I can see where you're moving, and I appreciate it as well. And I think probably if you're a teacher or you're working in the education system and you're listening to this, you can really probably connect to those ideas of well-becoming, that those questions that you're asking. You know, yeah, it's of course it's important to know how are students doing at this moment, but also how are they growing their awareness of how they are at the moment and how that might affect them as they move forward. And I think that that's something that a lot of teachers are really thinking about all the time. So I appreciate that explanation a lot. And it's a big mouthful to say well-being and well-becoming all the time, and yet you don't want to miss the one, and sometimes that well-being is the way we get in towards the becoming. So I appreciate that explanation. That really helps. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about your framework at all, or how you're working with that? I think you've said a lot, so it don't necessarily have to, but I just want to make sure before we moved on. Yes.
And there is this freely available paper on our website, right, that people can have a look at. I think I've set up the foundation or the lens to which one can start reading that piece. It's not, and maybe I'll add one more component that might be important to keep in mind, because that might distinguish it from some other approaches to conceptualizing well-being and flourishing. And that's the emphasis on this being a framework for well-being and well-becoming. And why I wanted to emphasize that, why I think it's important to emphasize this, is because I've come to the understanding from the literature, also my own experience in my own life and as an educator, that we have to be careful to be too concrete and specific in the conceptualization, because we have the tendency to see the world just through our eyes. I mean, in the end, that's all we can do, but we can be more sensitive to other cultural experiences. And there's enough empirical research out there that warns us to be too narrow-minded in our perspective on the world based on our own cultural upbringing. And so in this sense, I think I want to emphasize that this is a framework which, in the concrete use, let's say in a school division or in a province or for educational research, it needs to be specified what the concept would look like in this specific cultural, social-cultural and context in which it is to be used. So what if, for instance, one component of the framework is living a meaningful life? Now, what that in that generic terms, that's less useful if you want to help students, for instance, if you want to develop a curriculum based on a focus on well-being. So you have to be actually more specific, and what it means to live a meaningful life will look quite differently in, let's say, in more individualistic oriented society that we live in than in a more collectivistic oriented societies that some other countries represent. And so I think that's important to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And I think it really bridges into the rest of the work that you do, because I think because it's a framework, you're interested in looking at what that might look like in different contexts as well. And so in my decade of knowing you, I've certainly observed you working with educational communities in our province in really mindful, collaborative, service-focused ways. And a lot of the well-being and well-becoming in schools work that you're doing happens because of the relationships that you have nurtured in the educational community. Can you tell me a little bit more about how and why you've developed partnerships in Manitoba and beyond?
Are you thinking more general or specifically to the well-being projects?
I would say maybe in general how you've come to work. And I think maybe like Manitoba is a smaller province. So it's a province where you actually can make some of these partnerships in different ways than perhaps you could in larger areas. So how have you been able to work within this smaller province to build relationships and to make some, start that work that really is starting to make a big impact both on programming and policy and all sorts of things in our province? Just the conversation around well-being and well-becoming. I know when I mentioned that I do well-being and well-becoming before I even mention your name, people are like, oh, do you work with Thomas? Yes, I do. So it's that kind of thing. How did some of that work start for you, and or how did that happen, or why is it important?
I mean, this goes back to my response to your very first question. It was my work as an educator and now as a scholar and educator is really driven by wanting to make a difference in the education system. Now, because you have to limit yourself in some way, my focus is on the school education system. And so with my move to Manitoba, I was interested in the Manitoba education school system. And so which was the reason why got into the academy in the first place. I mean, I had influence as a teacher on the education system, but it was often generally limited to my classroom. And now I teach teachers who then go out in the classroom, and I work with school divisions and with teachers. And so my sense was that I could have a greater impact this way than staying a classroom teacher. So when I came to Winnipeg, of course, it's a big move from the West Coast to Winnipeg, not knowing anyone, new province. I've never taught here in Winnipeg or in Manitoba. And so at the beginning, it was difficult to make connections. And in hindsight, I was wondering why. And I mean, now having been for 15 years here, I got a bit of a sense of this, including the kind of the province we are in. And so I've seen the school system now from the other end as well, not just from the classroom teacher end. And schools are very busy places. Teachers are very busy. They work more than 100%. They're 40 hours a week. And so if you want to make connections as an outsider, then you better have something that they can use, right? They don't have additional time to spend on you generally, right? And so it's very difficult to come in and make the connections unless you have something specific that is of use in this particular context. And I have great appreciation for this, right? I'm not complaining about this at all. And there's a little bit of, and I think a second component that played a role. So in this sense, it was really accidental. And I saw this with some of my colleagues as well when I came 15 years ago. It was some had connections built, long-term relationships built, and others were just sporadic or not at all, and chose their research in other areas than in the classroom or with teachers. And it meant if you wanted to build connections, you had to build trusting relationships, and that takes time. And often the academy has no appreciation for that work. The criteria that we are assessed by, right, is research publications. There's university services that we have to provide. So spending a day a week in the school system isn't as rewarded in the academy. And so there are forces that work against each other. But of course, over the years, and because I was persistent as well, and through connections and links, and as I'll mention in a moment, more accidental connections, as often happens, and the support by individuals, I made some some inroads and made connections. And I think what did play a role, something that you already hinted at, it's something special about Manitoba, at least if I compare this to the West Coast or larger provinces. One is, if it's smaller, people know each other. So if you're known and respected in one area, people talk about this, and it's much easier to expand further. And the other piece is, I found coming to Manitoba, there has been already and is still going on a sense of being in this together, regardless whether you're a superintendent, a teacher, a principal, school-based principal, in the school board office, or whether you are even in the ministry, I found that. And so there are many committees, groups that allow these different groups, educational groups, to work together. And they know each other as well, which is a matter of size, but also a matter of this culture. There's a different culture. There's a culture of, we are in this together for the kids, for the students, for the children. And I think coming into this and this mindset that is less confrontational than it is in other provinces can be very beneficial. If you have something to contribute, or let's say, if it is perceived by the education system that you have something to contribute, then different doors open at different levels. And so I was lucky that actually at the time, more accidental, I was drawn into some of the work that the Manitoba Association of School Superintendents were doing, first in the area of math education and then later in sustainability. And then from there, it developed into well-being and well-becoming. And a crucial, very central role played Ken Klassen, who is now retired, but back then the executive director of the Manitoba Association of School Superintendents. And I cannot praise him enough for the leadership that he has done in this province more generally, but also for the well-being idea in the province. So the well-being work was very much got off the ground quite a bit through his promotion. So we had other reasons to meet and engage with each other. And in that context, we actually, he showed great interest in my research and interests in student well-being, which is not a surprise if you know Ken Klassen, that there was this affinity, right? This was really right along his heart and mind. And so he opened then some of the doors, provided me opportunities to speak to mass at some of the events. And so it took off from there in the province of Manitoba and actually beyond. So when they had national meetings at the superintendency levels, he promoted that as well. So I think it's as often the circumstantial, right people at the right place at the right time. And that's how it happened. You know? And it has, once it finds its grounds, I think then with his retirement, it doesn't just disappear as it sometimes happens, but it actually took off and is taken on. And I think that I take this as an indication that it resonates with educators and educational leaders, right? The concern for student well-being and well-becoming.
I agree. And I know that I've been lucky enough to get involved with some of the groundwork that you have started for us, in particular with one of the projects, which is called the WB2 Project. It's well-being and well-becoming in schools. And I know that Ken Klassen was a really big player in that as well. And in some of the episodes that will be coming up in our podcast, we're going to hear some of the examples from some of the schools and divisions that have been involved in that partnership. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the WB2 projects and partnerships, and how did it come about? What were some of the goals? What have you been noticing over the time that these WB2 projects have happened?
Well, since I was already talking about the great influence that Ken had on the whole project, maybe I'll just start with a little anecdote, because you're talking now about WB2. What the heck is that about? And when we started this project, and I'll tell you in a moment, I'll respond to your question and tell you the role that Ken played in this. But when we started this project, he said, I will not say just well-being and well-becoming. We just shortened this to WB2. And ever since, we've used that. And so that's a little anecdote there where this came from. And I'm appreciative in that regard as well, because it's a mouthful. So as I mentioned before, there were some occasions where Ken and I engaged with each other, and then he showed interest in my interest in and research in well-being and well-becoming and flourishing in schools. And out of that evolved the idea of, why don't we try, after I I had some opportunities to present to superintendents in some school divisions as well, a project, particularly at that time, because there was also some movement in at the ministry level. There was back then, was he was an assistant deputy minister, Rob Santos, in the Ministry of Education, or the department as it's called. And he came from actually Healthy Child Manitoba and was heavily invested in Healthy Child Manitoba, and well-being is a crucial concern in Healthy Child Manitoba. So he was promoting that at the ministry level, so, and Ken knew about that, of course. And so he saw in a connection and an opportunity here. So he brought the three of us together, Rob himself and myself, and strategizing what could we do in order to do something and support the school divisions at the concrete classroom level. And so we came up with the idea of maybe starting a pilot project where we bring together, and we wanted to start with middle schools for a particular reason, bringing together middle schools. And because it was Ken, he was recognizing, and quite rightly so, for this to really get a foothold, we have to involve the higher administration as well of a school division. So we were not just inviting principals and teachers for a school-based well-being project, but we also made a requirement that somebody from the central admin team need to be part of this project as well. And so we created that about, what was it, 3 years ago, I think. And we invited school divisions to express their interests. The minister provided some funding for traveling and meeting space. So we sent out the call, and we had quite a number of responses. And we decided to wanted to see the whole province represented. So we actually were lucky to have interest expressed from Winnipeg, the city, expressed from rural areas, from different areas, the west, the south, the north, and then the far north as well. And so we selected first round six school divisions, and then we met for a year, and then some of them wanted to continue. We expanded the invitation. Then we ended up with, I think it was 9 or 10 school divisions, and then we're now in our third year, or at the end, at the end of the third year, more or less, and we continued with the same group of school divisions. And the core ideas, as I mentioned already, was leadership support and at the same time a concrete student concerned project around well-being. Some of the principles behind this was it could be a project that you're already involved in, but the idea was to see it through a well-being lens. Now, there wasn't any framework, although I talked about my framework, there wasn't a requirement so that people felt comfortable with what they were doing. What was important is it had to be in a broader sense around student well-being, and it needed the support from the administration, highest level. And what was also important was, and right building from the beginning, and that's where then our work as university people became important. We also wanted them to, from the beginning, use data collection to assess the progress of the project and the impact of the project. And I think these were the components that characterized the project. And I think the fact that we still have, I'd say, 60-70% of those who were there in second year continuing the third year is an indication that the whole structure and the support that we provided, plus the financial support, was really helping them along with the project, and that they saw value in these projects.
So the divisions themselves got to decide on what they wanted to do for the projects. And now they get together, we try and bring together the groups about three times a year over the year. What have you noticed about the projects over the time, or kind of some of the development of how you think that the projects are contributing to both the division's understanding of well-being, but maybe more of a provincial even understanding of well-being for educators involved in the project?
Yes, these annual meetings, 3 to 4 times a year, were really important, and I was very happy to see that people regularly attended these meetings. And so the exchange and hearing what others are doing was an important component of the whole project. And I think what I informally observed was the importance of the, as we could call it now in light of the language that's used with the pandemic, the frontline educators, right? The importance of the frontline educators. While principals and sometimes assistant superintendents were present, the word was generally given to the frontline educators, to the principals, the teachers, because they were the drivers of this project. And so that was one observation that I had, and that I think probably also a factor in the continuation of these projects, that you had people who were highly invested in these projects and who saw with some support and the help that also we provided, that there is actually value in these projects, that we see progress, that we can assess how it is going, and that it is really about the main concern that they have for their children, which is in the end, are they really flourishing as children? Are they flourishing as students? And so, and there seemed to be a clear recognition and acknowledgement of that at the administration level. Another component was, I think, over the years, over the 3 years, was really a greater emphasis and a greater level of comfort in, among the different school divisions that came, or the groups that came, with assessing data collection, data interpretation. On the one hand side, it is clear that comes on top of all the other work that they already do, right? Because it's not just data collection, it's also interpreting those in a meaningful way, and then driving conclusions from that. And that comes all for teachers on top of the assessing of students, like the marking and writing report cards. And so that's additional work. But I saw informally much greater ease with the language, but also with the actual sense making of the data and the implications that that had for their practice. And the observation that I had is the move of some of the earlier school divisions, the ones who are now in the third year, the ones who started out 3 years ago, how they have used these projects to what in the literature is called upscaling. That they have gone from a small-scale project, which we also encourage them to do, right? Because it's better to start small than starting large and then having to give up because you don't have the resources available. So that actually school divisions use the experience that they have to upscale, either from one classroom to other classrooms of the same grade level, or from one grade level to now another grade level, or even in the case of one school division, from one feeder school to now several feeder schools that were looking at the transition issue from middle school to high school, which is a problem for, not a problem, but necessarily, but an issue for all middle schools, right, at some point. And so the school division used the learning from the initial project to expand further. And so if they see there's value, if the school division sees there's value in investing in these projects, then they expand further, and they have good data now collected to support the investment in these projects.
Yes, you're going to hear some of those examples in upcoming episodes of some of these upscaling projects. And it's fascinating to see how different all of the divisions took their projects. They're certainly not a cookie cutter approach at all. And you're right, I think from the times that I've listened as the groups have changed over the years, there is a greater confidence in working with data, and also a greater connection between the people in various divisions with various projects. People would not have these kinds of conversations, I don't think, if it wasn't for the time and the focus. And because they're feeling confident in the work that they're doing, they're being able to make connections with other divisions that may be doing something quite different, but might have some element that may help them grow what they're doing in their divisions as well. So the conversations, I feel, have been really rich when we've gotten all together. Great. Okay, I'm just going to ask you one other, and this will be kind of a briefer question. I mean, it probably could be a whole other episode, but just wondering if you wanted to talk about any other research or educational partnerships that you're currently involved in, or how your current work is shaping or changing your understandings of well-being and well-becoming in schools.
I would say it's actually the other way around. It is my work in well-being and well-becoming that shapes any other projects that I'm doing. I mean, the well-being and well-becoming work on its own is already a huge undertaking. But of course, there are other opportunities. And I'm also, in some sense, as a university teacher, involved in teaching math education to future teachers and to teachers who come back to do graduate work. And so the question for me then is, now when I look at my work in math education, or also sustainability education to some degree that I was involved prior to getting to my work in around well-being and well-becoming, I see all that now through the lens of the well-being and well-becoming. And I'll give you an example of that that is linked to a project that I'm now involved in. It's actually linked to a project you are involved in as well, writing something for maybe what might become a book at some point, is looking at math education through the lens of well-being and well-becoming. So then my thinking around math education at the school level, to narrow this down, is then framed by the question of what role can math education play to contribute to students' well-becoming? And even going one step further, what would math education look like in the classroom if the driving purpose of all school education, including teaching mathematics and learning mathematics, is really to help students live a flourishing life now and as in the future? So what would mathematics education look like? And so that's an example where it is more the other way around, that my other research is now, I can't help it, but looking at all the other work, and including my own teaching at the university, is shaped by a lens through which I have learned to see the world now, which is really the big concern for my own fellow humans' well-being and society more broadly, and for that matter, the whole planet and the well-being of the whole planet.
Well, I'm very grateful that you have this lens and that you are really using it to influence those who are around you on a day-to-day basis that some of us are lucky enough to be, but as well as others who get the chance to connect with you through your projects, through your research, through your connections across the province and the world. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about that and helping us also have that lens as we head into all the work that we do in our lives. I was wondering, is there anything else that you wanted to add or that I didn't give you the chance to talk about that you'd like to say about well-being and well-becoming in schools?
No, I don't think so. I think I talk quite a bit.
You've been excellent. It's been a fascinating conversation. I really do appreciate it, Thomas. I thank you for setting up a lot of the big ideas that we're hoping to explore in this podcast.
Schools of Wellbeing is hosted by me, Jen Watt. It is executive produced by Jen Watt and the amazing Rebecca Herringer. It is also edited by the yet more amazing Rebecca Herringer. The beautiful music is composed and performed by a recent Bachelor of Education student from the University of Manitoba, Malcolm Ericastia Summers. This podcast is funded through support from my University of Manitoba Research Startup Funds. It is hosted on the Wellbeing and Wellbecoming in Schools in Canada Research Initiative website, which is available at wellbeinginschools, all one word, .ca. Please feel free to email me comments or suggestions at jennifer.watt@umanitoba.ca or leave a review wherever you downloaded this podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Be well, everyone.